Hello there and welcome. Today is Thursday, May 18th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Laurie London in Washington. Coming up, there is now a special prosecutor taking over the Russia investigation. President Trump prepares for his first overseas trip since taking office. What's next for the U.S. efforts to deal with North Korea? Also ahead, the latest entertainment news involving two popular reality shows. It's all on today's International Edition. The U.S. Justice Department announced Wednesday that it has named Robert Mueller, a former director of the Federal Bureau of Investigation, as special counsel to oversee the investigation of alleged Russian government efforts to influence the 2016 presidential election and related matters. Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein said his decision to appoint a special counsel, also known as a special prosecutor, doesn't mean a finding that crimes have been committed or that any prosecution is warranted. The calls for the appointment have been growing in recent days after the firing of FBI Director James Comey, who'd been leading the investigation into the matter, and after reports on Tuesday that said Comey wrote a memo alleging Trump had asked him to end an investigation of former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn. Joining me now to discuss, former CIA officer Jack Rice. So what is your response to this latest development?
It's amazing that we're finally in a position where a special prosecutor has finally been chosen. And the choice is equally astonishing, bringing in a former FBI director himself.
What do we know about Robert Mueller in general?
He's pretty apolitical, and while he is generally known as a Republican, generally speaking, he's more known as a professional. Mm-hmm. So in other words, he doesn't hold that on his sleeve. Yes, he was originally appointed as director by George W. Bush, but it was also reappointed by Barack Obama. In fact, stayed in office for almost 12 years. So this is really somebody who's sort of above the fray and is seen as above the fray. And he also knows how to play.
Do you think that the president now has pretty much lost his ability to control the investigation? How big of a deal do you think this is?
Oh, I think he has lost control of the investigation. And one of the reasons he's lost control is there are so many people who are watching this now. There are so many eyes on this. And I think he's lost so much credibility because he said very specific things that have proven to not be true. And because of that, the quality of what he says is in question almost from the beginning. So I think you're seeing not just Democrats who are saying this, you're seeing Republicans. And I don't mean just first-term Congress people who were just elected in 2012 or 2014. I'm talking about long-standing, very senior Republicans who are starting to murmur about this president as they think about the midterms and as they think about the election in 4 years, which is about right now.
You're pretty confident that this will be a fair and impartial investigation into what happened with the 2016 election and Russia.
I think the choice of Robert Mueller as the special prosecutor is a brilliant choice, because what he will do is he will take a thorough, professional, balanced approach to try to figure out exactly what happened. And I think that the American people deserve that.
What about the work that's already been done by the FBI? Will that continue or will they start completely over?
The benefit that the special prosecutor has now is he can take all of that information and he can vacuum that up and then use that as a jumping off point. Because I think he can depend upon a lot of the investigation that's been done, at least in terms of what documents they have, in terms of the subpoenas that they may be able to reach out for. I mean, part of the job as special prosecutor is you can go out and look for people who may have committed federal crimes, and you can prosecute them. He has the right to do that himself. So he has that power, and he can exercise that power.
Does he also have the authority to order President Trump's tax returns or to be released?
It's a great question. What we do know is that he has broad authority to look at anything originally related to this question of the Trump administration, or at least the Trump team during the election, and the Russians. The obvious question then becomes, how far can he take this? Could he order President Trump's tax returns? If there is something that he could pin the question of a conflict of interest and maybe some benefit that the president has received from the Russians that may be tied to this issue, I would argue yes, he has that ability.
Three people so far that were a part of the president's administration that were involved in some way with this investigation have been fired. Does the president now have to cooperate?
That's the $10,000 question. What we have seen, according to former Director Comey, is that he tried to stop this investigation pretty clearly. And he has continued, and I use this word carefully, obstructed the investigation itself. Now, whether it's risen to the level of a crime is a separate question. The problem that the president faces is that every decision he makes will be compared to the decisions made by President Nixon during Watergate. And whether or not this is an effort to obstruct this investigation.
Last week, the White House said no need for any kind of special prosecutor or special counsel, as we now have. But after this news, the president released a statement saying he looks forward to this being resolved. There was no collusion between his presidential campaign and the Russians. Very reserved statement for the president. We haven't seen any threatening tweets or anything of the sort. Do you think this is a wake-up call?
As a former CIA case officer and as a former prosecutor myself and as a criminal defense attorney, if the president had called me, asked me for advice, there's a whole series of things I would have suggested that he do. The very first one is put down his damn phone. Stop what you're doing, because what you're doing is you're undercutting your message, but what you're also creating are very specific statements that come from you about your motivation. And part of that could support the claim of obstruction. And so he needs a lawyer. He should be listening to that lawyer if he has any idea about what may be coming for him.
All right. That's former CIA officer Jack Rice. Thank you for your perspective. Well, President Trump delivered the commencement address Wednesday to cadets at the U.S. Coast Guard Academy in New London, Connecticut, telling them that they soon will play vital roles in protecting America's borders from drug smugglers and human traffickers. And the president used his own experiences as an example of why the recent graduates should never give up.
Over the course of your life, you will find that things are not always fair. You will find that things happen to you that you do not deserve and that are not always warranted. But you have to put your head down and fight, fight, fight. Never, ever, ever give up. Things will work out just fine.
That's Trump. Then went on to list several things he's accomplished since becoming president, which included reducing the number of illegal border crossings. Well, President Trump is also about to embark on his first foreign trip, a 9-day journey that takes him to the seats of the world's three main religions and signals a sharp change from his predecessor's approach toward the Middle East. White House correspondent Peter Heinlein reports the first stop is Saudi Arabia, where Trump hopes to re-energize the Sunni Muslim coalition against Iran.
When you hear about the tough
during the 2016 campaign, Donald Trump complained about Saudi Arabia, his threat to halt Muslim immigration and his temporary ban on travel from some Muslim countries opened him up to charges of Islamophobia. Now, however, he's chosen Riyadh as the symbolic first stop on his first overseas tour.
Saudi Arabia is the custodian of the two holiest sites in Islam, and it is there that we will begin to construct a new foundation of cooperation and support with our Muslim allies to combat extremism, terrorism, and violence.
For Trump, this is a chance to counter his anti-Muslim image. In Riyadh, he will receive a grand welcome from as many as 20 kings, emirs, and presidents of Sunni Muslim countries. His message: the United States will stand with them against what they see as the hostile power in the region, Iran.
He will encourage our Arab and Muslim partners to take bold new steps to promote peace and to confront those from ISIS to Al-Qaeda to Iran to the Assad regime who perpetuate chaos and violence that has inflicted so much suffering throughout the Muslim world and beyond.
Human rights groups have criticized Trump for hosting authoritarian leaders such as Egypt's Abdel Fattah el-Sisi and Turkey's Recep Tayyip Erdogan. That's a sharp break from the approach of Barack Obama, who distanced himself from the Sunni leadership due to human rights concerns.
When he was in Cairo, delivered a big speech, but over the heads of Arab leaders, directly to the people of the Middle East. Donald Trump has a very different approach. He's going to speak to leaders, people that he can deal with man to man. This is his preference.
Saudi national Ali Shihabi, an expert with the Arabia Institute in Washington, says Trump's message is just what the Sunni leaders want to hear.
He is going there to send a message that says that he understands that actually the his Muslim allies, America's Muslim allies, are the first line of defense to fight against terrorism, which is a top priority for him. And he also understands that to fight against terrorism, one has to deter Iran from being mischievous and taking advantage of chaos in the Middle East to further her own political ambitions.
From Riyadh, Trump travels to Israel, then to the Vatican, completing a swing through the seats of the three great monotheistic religions. He'll then attend a NATO summit and a G7 summit before heading home. Peter Heinlein, VOA News, the White House.
Here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. The U.S. extends Obama-era nuclear sanctions relief for Iran. Another kidnapped Nigerian schoolgirl escapes. A possible U.S. troop increase in Afghanistan is aimed at breaking a stalemate. And a U.S. campus uses high-tech center to keep students safe. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. The UN Security Council held a closed-door meeting on Wednesday to discuss the deteriorating situation in Venezuela, where nearly daily anti-government protests have rocked the country for more than 6 weeks. The United States called for the meeting, which marks the first time the 15-nation council, which is responsible for international peace and security, has taken up the matter. U.S. Ambassador Nikki Haley, after emerging from the meeting, says Venezuela is on the verge of a humanitarian crisis.
What we attempted to do in this meeting today is about prevention. We've been down this road with Syria, with North Korea, with South Sudan, with Burundi, with Burma. We've been down this road. And rather waiting for a serious situation where we have to have it in an open Security Council meeting, why not get in front of this?
Peter Hakim is senior fellow at the Inter-American Dialogue in Washington.
Aside from, you know, the Haitian earthquake and some other natural disasters, this really is the worst man-made humanitarian, economic, governance crisis that I've seen in 50 years of watching Latin America.
Protesters are angry about the socialist country's downward economic spiral, which has led to food and medical supply shortages, and they blame President Nicolas Maduro for wrecking the economy. More than 40 people have been killed in the unrest since April 1st. Maduro blames the opposition for the country's problems, accusing his opponents of launching a coup against him with the support of Washington. On Tuesday, he extended the country's state of emergency for the seventh time. Well, North Korea's state-run news agency Yonhap reported that President Trump met Wednesday with a special envoy of South Korean President Moon Jae-in and that he looks forward to working closely with the new leader to resolve the North Korean nuclear issue. He reportedly said he's willing to make peace through engagement with Pyongyang under the right conditions. VOA's Victor Beatty asks Troy Stangerone with the Korean Economic Institute just what that might mean.
I think so far, both administrations are feeling each other out. We're seeing them all say the right thing. Moon Jae-in, after becoming president, has said, you know, that he supports sanctions and pressure on North Korea, but clearly he would like to engage. President Trump has reciprocated by saying that he's willing to make peace with North Korea through engagement. The challenge or the difficulty, I think, becomes as the two administrations move forward and they try to put together some, you know, concrete proposals on what policy should look like. how will this work out? There are things that I think Moon Jae-in has put forward, such as family reunions and having the North Koreans attend the Winter Olympics in 2018 in South Korea. And I think these are things that the administration could and should support. But I think, you know, right now we're still in an early stage to where both governments are trying to create space for each other.
Do you sense any interest on the part of Pyongyang to engage in dialogue?
We've heard some rhetorical comments. I mean, they, much as everyone else, have said that under the right conditions, no one has really got into what these right conditions are. But I think if we look at their behavior so far, it's difficult to see them really coming seriously to the table. Clearly, we should leave that option open. But when they continue to test at a pace of basically one missile test a month or so, I think it's hard to conclude that they're willing to come to talks.
South Korea's president on Wednesday said there was a high possibility of conflict with North Korea. What do you make of his comments just hours after his administration said it was interested in opening communication links with the North?
I think President Moon is trying to signal to the North that while he is willing to engage, they should not expect him to be weak on security. He's talked in the campaign, and one of his pledges is to essentially take and significantly increase defense spending to improve, while not necessarily through the THAAD system, South Korea's missile defense. And I think this is something North Korea should take seriously, that while South Korea is willing to find other paths, they will not sacrifice their security for those paths.
In a speech in Tokyo on Wednesday, the commander of U.S. Pacific Command, Admiral Harry Harris, called North Korea a clear and dangerous threat to the U.S., Japan, and South Korea, and stressed the need for more cooperation among allies and all countries to implement strong sanctions.
This is going to be the key. We have clearly a still relatively new administration in Washington. We have a very new administration in Seoul. If we're not able to get on the same page in terms of sanctions and, to be frank, how we want to engage North Korea. The North Koreans have been very good in the past at finding and exploiting differences. Be it sunshine or sanctions, they will both work best when we're all on the same page. And so part of that means not just bringing China onto the same page, but ensuring that Tokyo, Seoul, and Washington are all on the same page.
That will be key in the UN Security Council as new sanctions are considered. What might the outcome be?
One, maybe two occasions where the UN Security Council actually moved forward with the sanctions. I think, though, that we're at a point to where we need to be different when it comes to the ballistic missile tests. Essentially, these have been freebies, if you will. We have followed a pattern to where the North Koreans test. We all condemn the tests. They fall through with another test. Whether these are simply a slight incremental increase in sanctions or something more forward-looking that laid out a path for how to deal with future ballistic missile tests is unclear. But I do think we're at the point where they're testing frequently enough that we need to demonstrate to the North Koreans that there is a cost to these tests.
And what do you make of the experts who are, to a varying degree, saying that the North is perfecting its capability to launch a nuclear-tipped ballistic missile?
I think that's clear. The only reason for the continuous test is if you are trying to take and proceed as quickly as possible to perfecting a nuclear-tipped ballistic missile. We already presume that in the intermediate range that they have achieved this, but it's the intercontinental range that they still need to do testing on. And if we were to look at North Korea's own patterns, if this was simply a question of them trying to gain the world's attention or to take and move into talks to gain some temporary concessions before they, you know, go back again, I think when we look at this in terms of either trying to sort of predict tests or wonder if there's other reasons for this, that we're really doing a disservice by not focusing on what clearly they're doing, which is to try and advance the program as quickly as they can.
That's Troy Stangerone with the Korean Economic Institute. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hey there, this is Shauna Renee, the lady DJ and host of Soul Lounge. Every Sunday at 1400 UTC, I choose an artist that you and I love, and we break down their entire career while listening to their biggest hits. That's what we do here on the Soul Lounge. Once again, every Sunday, 1400 UTC, right here.
Hello, sports fans. This is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports.
I love Sunny Side of Sports.
Please join us for a whole half hour of sports talk and news Monday through Friday at 1630 and 1830 UTC GMT. On the internet, you can like me on Facebook, follow me on Twitter, and read my blog. Visit voaafrica.com
and enjoy the show.
VOA's International Edition continues now with entertainment news, and for that, we're joined by Rare.us content editor Nicole Muscella. Hey, Nicole, last week we talked about the return of phenomenally popular singing contest American Idol, and I understand you have more details now.
Yes, we have more details on the reboot of American Idol. It's coming to ABC. It's making the switch from Fox. And actually, the CEO of Fox, her name is Dana Walden, talked to the press this week and said that Fox had big plans to bring Idol back, but they were going to wait until 2020. So they were just as surprised as anybody when ABC made the announcement that they were bringing it back in 2018. But the latest is we do have at least two confirmed judges. Katy Perry confirmed yesterday on Instagram that she will be joining the judges table. And we also have Chris Daughtry, who was a contestant in season 5 of American Idol. He did not win. He came in fourth place. And the latest gossip around this is the season 5 winner, Taylor Hicks, went on an interview and said something. He passed a little shade on to Chris Daughtry, and he said, you know, I think a winner maybe should be on the judges table, not somebody who came in third or fourth or fifth place. So that's kind of interesting that he threw that little jab over at Chris Daughtry. And he kind of danced around, Taylor Hicks danced around that he may be in talks with the network to join the judges table too. So if they're on there together, it could create a little tension for the viewers.
That should be interesting for sure. We always like that on our reality shows.
Yes.
And then you've got some interesting news about another reality show, Dancing with the Stars, which we were also just talking about last week.
Yes. Last week, everybody thought Simone Biles is going to take home this Mirrorball trophy. She is going to be the winner, just like her Team USA teammate Lori Hernandez won last year. And this week, it was such a shocking elimination when she wound up being eliminated with her partner, Sasha Farber. The two of them were in the bottom two with a baseball player named David Ross. And when it was announced that Simone Biles was going home after earning not one, but two back-to-back perfect scores for her performances on Monday night, you could hear a pin drop in that room. Everybody was on their feet. The judges were gasping. It was really shocking that she was sent home. She did keep a big smile on her face, even though she was eliminated, and she assured her fans that she'll be back next week and enjoy the finale just like the rest of us. So she was a good sport about it, so good for her, but I was sad to see her go.
All right, that's Rare.us content editor Nicole Muscella. Thanks for being with us. And turning now to the latest on what's trending on social media, we are joined by Andrew Palchewski. Hey, Andrew, what's happening?
Well, there's a theme today that blocked social media around the world.
Really?
Yes. So we start in Ukraine. Ukraine recently announced that they are blocking the Russian social media site VK, known as the Russian version of Facebook, because of the, let's just say, difficult relationship between those two countries. They're blocking actually a number of different Russian internet and digital communication companies, television stations, all of these digital and communications channels that they're blocking. Well, VK doesn't want to lose its Ukrainian audience, so they've actually sent out information to Ukrainian users on how to bypass that blockage. They say, we love our Ukrainian fans, we want to keep them. And so there's a bit of gamesmanship now between the Ukrainian government and this Russian social media network going back and forth.
Oh, that's interesting, for sure, with all the news of Russia lately.
Yes, and so it's just an example of how these digital companies can really have a role on the world stage. It's not just about sharing cat photos or talking to your friends and family. There can be real implications. And that leads us to our next story in Thailand. Thailand has some very strict laws on media, particularly involving that country's king. And the Thai government said to Facebook this week, unless Facebook removed some illegal pages from being accessed in Thailand, they would ban the social network in the country. There was one post in particular that they were upset about. It was a video that appeared to show the country's king walking through a shopping mall in a yellow crop top. not clear if that video has been verified, if that was actually the king, but even just depicting what might be the king in that way could cause some trouble. So Thai authorities asked Facebook to remove that content. Facebook came back and banned some of the content, said that they will go through and look at what is considered illegal, and that's the stuff they will ban. But it's not clear that Facebook banned all of the content they wanted. So the deadline was Tuesday. The deadline came and went. Facebook has not been blocked in Thailand, even though Facebook apparently did not remove every single thing that the Thai authorities asked for. So it sounds like Facebook may have won this kind of standoff.
Why,
at
every
the
day,
moment. Yes.
We're talking about Facebook.
Yes, but it just shows the power that certainly Facebook has, that it can remove some of these things, not everything, and still be allowed in that country. I believe it's one of the most, if not the most popular social networks in Thailand, certainly the most popular in the world. So we'll see if we get more requests like that coming forward. This is something we see from time to time. Social networks are asked to remove content that violates laws or that deals with censorship, and sometimes they go ahead and remove that if they feel that it is illegal, but sometimes there is a standoff. So this is a story that's not going to go away. It's not just going to be in Thailand, but I think around the world we're going to see more and more of these stories as Facebook continues to grow and as other social networks continue to grow as well.
All right, Andrew Palchevsky, you can follow him on Twitter at apal. Thanks so much for joining us. You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. And thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Jimmy Cook. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Defense Secretary Jim Mattis recently attended a defense ministerial in Denmark with members of the Global Coalition Against ISIS to discuss how to defeat the group. In a press conference following the meeting, Secretary Mattis said, "We're going to further accelerate this fight and to free the people currently suffering from Daesh's crushing occupation and our enemy's terror threat to Europe and beyond." Denmark's defense minister, Claus Hjort Frederiksen, described the effort to defeat ISIS as one of Denmark's highest priorities and agreed to substantially increase the country's defense budget to aid in the counter-ISIS campaign. ISIS has lost well over half its territory in Iraq and in Syria. In Afghanistan, the enemy has lost about two-thirds of its strength. Moreover, Afghan President Ashraf Ghani recently announced the death of Sheikh Abdul Hasib, the emir of ISIS Khorasan, an affiliate of ISIS in Afghanistan. In our anti-ISIS campaign, said Secretary Mattis, we are dealing that group one more significant blow with the loss of their leader. Secretary Mattis cautioned that the battlefield against ISIS is also a humanitarian issue, where innocent people live right now, sometimes forced to stay on the battlefield by ISIS. We're going to do everything humanly possible to limit the suffering and any casualties among those innocent people, he said. Once the ISIS threat is subdued, said Secretary Mattis, the real work of rebuilding begins in order to prevent another terrorist group from filling the void. And how do we do that? Bottom line is we've got to restore government services, and that means we all have to work together. ISIS has done horrible damage, said Secretary Mattis. That's why the U.S. is committed to working with its allies to defeat ISIS wherever it attempts to establish its roots.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.